Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated, a weekly roundup of the who's who and the what's what in the arts and culture scene here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Patrick Ford, Aspen Public Radio's arts and culture reporter. Each week, we'll bring you conversations and stories about notable happenings in our little slice of the world. Today on Curated, we learn how to tell a great story.
You know, you watch movies with actors who really know what they're doing. It's a marvelous thing to witness. You know, in a single glance, you get the whole picture.
The film festival has more women involved than ever before.
We have to pick up the camera if we want to see it. We can't wait for somebody else to do it. If we want to see this change, we have to pick up the camera, and Hillary did.
First Draft host Mitzi Rapkin speaks with writer Igoni Barrett, and we see what happens to the arts during the off-season.
We don't have many people on campus right now, so it's much quieter from that point of view. But in the office, the activity level is at its highest level.
All of that, plus our Song of the Week, and as always, The Week in the Arts. A quick rundown of the top things to see, hear, and experience this week in the Valley. That's all coming up on Curated from Aspen Public Radio News. The art of storytelling has been passed down through generations. Antonio Hacha has been perfecting that art as he tours around the world telling stories to people of all ages. He spoke recently in Carbondale. I spoke with Antonio about what makes a great story and how hard it is to have it appeal to everyone in the audience. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Antonio, the first thing I want to ask you as a storyteller, what makes a good story?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. What makes a good story? I believe that what makes a good story is a story that resonates well with the listener. There are several phases. I was actually talking to somebody about this yesterday. A good story is a story that first touches you and it resonates with you. You know, it speaks about something that you care about. And then the other job of the storyteller is once that story is collected, then that story has to resonate with the listener. And that's the job of the storyteller, is to match listener with story.
Let me stop you there for a second. Is what you do similar to maybe what like a comedian would do? Maybe if he sees a joke he's telling and it's just not working in the room, you might change the direction of the story at all. Maybe what I'm asking is how much leeway do you have when you're up on stage telling a story?
Well, I can have a lot of leeway. You say once I open my mouth and say once upon a time and the story is rolling, I can adapt the story to, you know, the speed with which I deliver it. I can choose not to dwell in certain details, but just go straight to the next chunk of, you know, part of the story.
Yeah, like maybe if you can know that like one part of the story isn't going to work for this particular audience, and you realize that once you've already started telling the story.
Yeah. I had something happen to me in India in which I had to stop the story, actually. I was not listening well at all. I was in India, and I'm telling the story, and the story is going really well. People are engaged, but there's a cow in the story that gets killed. Okay? I mean, this is like classic. This is classic, like, whoops. I mean, it had to be that, right? It had to be that. It could not have been anything else, but it had to be that. And I stopped telling the story. And I said, this, you know, it's a story that did not take place in India. And I told them, I said, I'm sorry about this moment in the story, but that meant no offense to their culture and belief system. That this was a story in a place far, far away from India, as they knew from the opening of the story. And they looked at me, and some of them smiled at me, and I got this great amount of sympathy and carry-on attitude from the audience. And I went back, and I finished the story, you know.
You've trained as a mime as well, and you're very, you move a lot during these performances. You've talked about using your body as a whole to tell a story. I wonder, why is that important to you? What makes that special?
We got to be careful with the word special there, but it works for me because the body is the first thing the audience notices, right? You get on stage to do anything. What is there? Your body. Whether you're a singer, a harp player, whether you're going to recite a poem, your body is the first thing that the audience is coming in contact with visually. And body language is a powerful language. You can deny what you're saying with your body language. You can say you are okay, but if your body language looks otherwise, the person you're talking to knows you're not okay, and vice versa. So the body is really a foundation for everything we do. You can manipulate the body language to control subtext. I have to listen to the story. Does the story require a lot of movement? You know, is it more subtle? Some somber stories I tell, some stories, supernatural stories. I don't have a lot of those, but some of the ones I tell, I'm very, very subtle with movement.
I've heard you talk about being maybe a fan of minimalism as well. Is that what you're kind of hinting at? What plays into that there?
Absolutely. In my humble opinion, less is more. And you know, when you think about it, that's what eloquence is all about. Whether it's verbal, whether it's physical, whether it's written, whether it's a piece of architecture, an object. When you build something for a certain purpose, everything that is in that object serves that same purpose. And that's eloquence. And when you deliver a verbal narrative and you're moving, you have everything has to serve that essence. And that is what less is more is all about, is that it is so concentrated that you get everything. You know, you watch movies with actors who really know what they're doing. It's a marvelous thing to witness. You know, in a single glance, you get the whole picture. That's what I'm trying to achieve in my work.
Antonio Hasha, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, pleasure, Patrick. It's thank you so much for speaking with me.
You're listening to Curated from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Patrick Fort. Follow Aspen Public Radio on Twitter or Instagram, or like us on Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick B. Fort. It's the off-season. Venues and restaurants are getting awfully quiet, but what happens behind those doors? I went out to see what happens when the people leave.
As a venue that holds all sorts of events, the Wheeler Opera House has to be flexible in what shows it will book. One week, it could be screening movies. The next, a series of concerts and comedians. But when the off-season comes along, the calendar pretty much dries up. For the people that run the place, it's the opposite.
I can't keep my dates straight anymore because all I think about is 2017.
Jenna Bueller, the executive director of the Wheeler, says she goes into full planning mode when the venue's schedule slows down.
We're starting to do a lot of our Mountain Summit, Mountain Film in Aspen festival planning as well. And then looking at all of those things that you kind of had to put aside during the winter season, those things start happening now.
There are so many ideas and plans that get pushed aside during the busy times of the year that only get to be discussed during the off season. A few miles down the road, Nancy Wilhelms is also hard at work preparing the Anderson Ranch Arts Center for its summer events. Even though the artists in residence have gone, she feels like she gets busier.
When I first came here, I ran right into everybody's expectation that since the campus wasn't loaded with people, then of course all you people at Anderson Ranch are taking time off and there's nothing going on and things are slow.
Just like the Wheeler Opera House, things ramp up at Anderson Ranch. They actually have a dedicated day where they do landscaping work. It's a little different, though, at the ranch. Art exhibits last for a month at a time, and there are occasionally speaking engagements. But even though it seems like nothing is going on, things ramp up behind the scenes.
We don't have many people on campus right now, so it's much quieter from that point of view. But in the office, the activity level is at its highest level.
Anderson Ranch is also preparing for its 50th anniversary festivities later this summer. Jenna Bueller, back at the Wheeler, struggles with getting artists who can draw enough people while being able to keep the price down during a time when locals are getting less work and fewer tips.
You know, when you're looking to fill 500 seats, or even for us, you know, 250 seats is always, you know, a good off-season goal there. So it's a balance, and it's trying to figure out who can come, who's not here. You know, it's kind of a crapshoot the way it goes.
The schedules ramp up again in June. This week's guest for First Draft is Nigerian novelist Igoni Barrett. His book is called Black Ass and tells the story of a Nigerian black man who wakes up a white man on the day of his job interview. In this segment of First Draft, Barrett tells host Mitzi Rapkin about how he came up with the idea for the novel and his inspiration from Kafka's The Metamorphosis.
I mean, there were two things. In the first place, it was an idea I had put down in my pocket notebook some years ago, while I was still writing my second story collection. And the idea was encapsulated in one sentence, which went like this. A young man wakes up on the morning of his job interview to discover that he's white. That sentence was there for many years. I didn't know what I was going to do with it until I decided it was time to write a novel. You know, after I'd finished my short story collection, I decided now I would attempt my first novel. And I went through several ideas I'd put in my notebook and in the end found that the idea that intrigued me, you know, most was this sentence about the young man waking up. And then at that point, when I had decided that was the story I was going to tell, I realized it was, you know, similar to the Metamorphosis. So I went back to reread The Metamorphosis, and one of the things I got out of the story of Kafka's story this time was my reading of Gregor Zamza's character. Gregor Zamza is the main character in The Metamorphosis, and my reading of his character, and I was kind of rooting for him, you know, to escape his family, to go out into the world and explore his insecthood. And when he didn't, he remained at home and eventually died. I realized that my character, my main character, was going to be, in many ways, the polar opposite of Gregor Zamza. But then I sat down to write the book, and once my character took the first decision in my book, you know, that decision to leave home, I realized that the metamorphosis was basically, I was done with the metamorphosis, and it was time to set out on my own.
One of the things I was wondering is this idea of waking up white has such obvious social ramifications in America. What does that mean to wake up white in Nigeria? Maybe if you could explain to our American audience that I don't know if it's different or not than here.
It is different. And that's one of the things I wanted to explore in the book. Nigerians are fond of saying we have no racism in our society because, after all, you know, it's a society that's nearly 99.9% black. You know, we have very few white Nigerians, and they are usually questioned all the time about their Nigerianness. You know, so if in the book you'll find that almost everybody who comes across the main character are surprised at his accent and ask him how can he be Nigerian. White people in Nigeria are considered foreigners, even if they had been born in Nigeria and they carried Nigerian passports, they're still seen as, you know, foreigners. And so I wanted to explore that in the book, that idea of deciding a person's nationality or what a person is based only on skin color. But then I also wanted to, you know, to look at the ramifications of that way of looking at people for Nigerians. What I realized in writing the book is that if you, as a black Nigerian, see someone and you are already making judgments and making assumptions based only on their skin color, that also says something about you know, about black people, because then it means you're also making assumptions about other black people based on their skin color.
Yeah, it is interesting when you talk about how black people view each other, because your main character, Furrow, wakes up on the day of his job interview and he's white and he slips out of his house and he makes it to the job interview. And it's almost like once he shows up, at first people think he's in the wrong place. But then when he says that he's there for the interview, they kind of roll out the red carpet and they want a man exactly like him. And so what does that say about all the other applicants who were black?
There's a section in the book where I say the white person in Nigeria is basically, you know, considered to have a dollar sign stamped on their head. And it's a way of looking at people. So the average Nigerian considers the white man foreigners, you know, so they probably come from rich countries with good educational systems and have access to opportunities. And so that's the view that the average black Nigerian will consider the average white man in Nigeria to be better educated, to be wealthier. And so there's always that surprise, usually that surprise when the white man tries to mix with the average Nigerian. Now, that is a stereotype that has its roots in reality, because the vast majority of white people in Nigeria are foreigners, and the vast majority of them are rich, you know, are wealthy, because they work for the multinationals or the global bureaucracies, and they drive around in chauffeured cars, and they don't mix. They usually stay in their secluded, you know, areas and don't mix. And so over time, that has become the view of whites in Nigeria. So when you find the exceptional one, you know, it usually is a, you know, shock to the system.
That was writer Igoni Barrett speaking with First Draft host Mitzi Rapkin. You can hear their entire conversation online at aspenpublicradio.org. Last week's Five Point Film Festival had a little bit of a different flair. The film series featured more pictures by or about women than it has before. I spoke with some of the women involved. When Hillary Oliver would go to film festivals, she felt that something was missing.
Women I knew were getting frustrated because they would go to these adventure film festivals and not see anything that represented what they felt like was their experience in the outdoors. And they would come back being like, where were all the women? You know, we didn't see any women climbers. We didn't see any films by women. We just saw guys' stories.
But now the writer turned film director is having her first ever production premiere at the Five Point Adventure Film Festival later this week. Her movie, Being Here, is a poem over shots of her doing what she loves, spending time outside.
My territory expands with the horizon. I'm finding my path, remembering my power, that I am strong and connected.
The idea for Oliver's film came from the time she spent living in a van with her boyfriend, traveling around the American West.
When I remember waking up at home and just thinking, oh, I wish I was waking up in my sleeping bag outside and watching a sunrise and missing that kind of quiet moment. And the way you can really think in a moment like that, that you can't when you're, you know, when your alarm is going off in the morning and you're thinking about work.
Sarah Wood, the executive director of the festival, says people had been asking for years why there were so few films featuring women. It's a problem that she thinks stems from the source of material.
When you have, you know, 300 films submitted by or about men and you have 10 submitted by or about women, most of your program's going to be films by or about men.
Or it could be that outdoor sports are just starting to be fully embraced by women and are becoming more welcoming. Emily Harrington stars in the film Role Reversal. Harrington is a professional climber and helps her father to achieve one of his climbing goals.
He actually likes climbing and isn't just the dad who stands on the sidelines or belays. He actually climbs for himself. Tomorrow we start the project.
Harrington says her father pushed her to go outside when she was younger. Maybe now, she says, that's becoming more common.
You know, slowly but surely, females start to catch on. They start to see other girls participating, and then they get motivated, and then they start to participate as well. So, you know, I just think, you know, maybe we're at a little bit of a disadvantage through history or something like that. And maybe when back in the day, girls weren't as encouraged to go and play outside.
And now that more women are starting to get into the adventure film business, Sarah Wood says it's time for them to step up and do something for themselves.
We have to pick up the camera if we want to see it. We can't wait for somebody else to do it. If we want to see this change, we have to pick up the camera. And Hillary did.
Hillary Oliver's film crew was all women. It wasn't intentional, she says, but it helped her to put a feminine touch on what she was trying to convey in her film. She missed the time she spent outdoors, both alone and with her boyfriend.
It was a really special time for me and for both of us in a lot of ways, but I just spent more mornings waking up to sunrises and hearing the birds sing and going to sleep, looking at the stars more than any other time in my life.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Patrick Fort. This week, Jazz Aspen Snowmass is holding an event which highlights high school jazz musicians in the Valley. I myself played in a jazz band in high school, and for this song of the week, I've gone with one of the songs that was my favorite to play in those years when I was in that jazz ensemble. That's The Way You Look Tonight, and my favorite version is sung by Frank Sinatra.
When the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. Yes, you're lovely with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft. There is nothing for me but to love you and the way you look tonight. With each word, your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart. And that laugh wrinkles your nose, my foolish heart. Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight. Touches my foolish heart. Lovely, don't you ever change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight. Just the way you look tonight.
That was The Way You Look Tonight, sung by Frank Sinatra. Welcome to the beginning of another week in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Patrick Fort, arts and culture reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. It's Monday, April 25th, and this is The Week in the Arts, an abbreviated list of the upcoming events and happenings in the Valley. An informational meeting about the Miss Strawberry Days Scholarship is being held at Bighorn Toyota in Glenwood Springs on Monday. It's the 119th year of the festival, which gives out a total of $8,000 in scholarships to four local women. Though Prince is no longer with us, you can still relive one of the highlights of his prolific career at the Belly Up on Wednesday. The film Purple Rain is being screened. The movie stars Prince and features his band The Revolution. The soundtrack for the film was some of the best music the artist made. Jazz Aspen Snowmass presents its student showcase on Wednesday in Carbondale. The event features jazz ensembles from local high schools up and down the valley, and it also includes students who participate in the Jazz Aspen Snowmass Beat Lab program. Thursday at the Belly Up, the legendary Graham Nash performs. There are a whole bunch of ways you might know him. He worked with the Hollies and obviously Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. His latest album, This Path Tonight, was released earlier this month. Saturday is Independent Bookstore Day. Celebrate at stores like Explore Booksellers in Aspen and Book Train in Glenwood Springs. For more on arts and culture in the Roaring Fork Valley or to list your event, go to aspenpublicradio.org. You're listening to Aspen Public Radio on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station. This is Curated, a weekly show dedicated to arts and culture. I'm Patrick Fort at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.